holds the phone away from his face, stares at him mysteriously. He passes out for 2 days and the whole world fucks up without him? Ridiculous. He slowly puts his cell back to his ear. Okay, we'll go to dinner tomorrow. Okay? Okay. Pete ends the call and drops his BlackBerry over the side of the tub onto a towel, then carefully drips his head beneath the water to get all the Bumble and Bumble Cool Brunette conditioner out of his hair. He wonders how long he can hold his breath, tries really very hard to pass out again, and then realizes he's had a much easier time of it on Seroquel. He tries it on Seroquel and wakes up safe in bed somehow, except with slightly damp hair. Safe, except he had a dream that he was with a homicidal mermaid. The fuck even? Pete takes the bus to Intelligentsia in Silver Lake, and after 5 cups of espresso and 15 minutes of serious introspection, bows off Seroquel. He means to go out with Belle, but he goes to her place, and she's either passed out or she's not around, so he figures, you know, fuck it, and goes home. He's at the Barney side, a Barney sale, Beverly Hills, of course. He likes New York, not enough to brave Fifth Avenue around Fashion Week. That's just suicide. When some kid, 14, 15, sprints past him, literally running, white blonde hair flying behind him or her, whatever, it's impossible to tell by the clothing. Running in Barney's is simply not done. Pete looks around instinctively for the kid's parents. Instead, he sees 2 security guards racing in his direction, and he realizes the kid was shoplifting. He sighs and goes back to rifling through fedoras. He wants a green one, with a feather through it. It's insane that he can't find one. It's not like he's, whatever, reaching for the fucking stars here. None of the salespeople will come help him either, because quite like Lana Del Rey, he looks like he was born dead. Whatever. Everyone knows that Seroquel withdrawal is always shit. Pete pops half his Xanax and decides to go to Pinkberry for a frozen yogurt. There's this kid with way crazy eyes wandering through the tunnels between the Beverly Center when Pete leaves Pinkberry. He could just leave through the main entrance, like a normal person. He knows this. But he went on a class trip as a kid once to the mall, and they taught them all about security systems and emergency exits. And now he's fucking ace at getting out of the labyrinth. It's like a guaranteed 20 minutes of fun every time. Even television can't promise you that. God damn, the shamelessly intrusive youth of America. Have you seen a boy with white hair and a waistcoat and a pocket watch? I'm sorry, a big, like, old gold watch on a string? Are you high? I dropped some acid, like, yesterday. Like, wow, did you really wear even... Do you live in a fucking time capsule in Sherman fucking Oaks? Pete snares, mostly unconsciously. Mocking Valley kids is a reflex. Whatever. Fuck off. Stop doing LSD. That's so 40 years ago. Who even are you? Al? Alexis, but Al, look, I'm kind of lost. I usually don't read things this long. Okay. Pete hates when people try to tell him that they love him because he doesn't get it. He knows they don't mean love like family, like friends. They mean love like, I want to marry you and have babies with you and move to the valley and buy a house with you and send our kids to horrifying public schools and die of whatever the same exact strain of influenza. Pete doesn't love anyone like that. He never has. He doesn't understand it. He's pretty sure Wendy loves him like that, and so does Tigris, but that maybe comes from him saving her life and all, more than anything else. Pete loves him like that, that's for goddamn sure. I don't know. It's... Oh, okay. Why are you calling me? Isn't there a review online somewhere? I'm in San Francisco. What? And Google doesn't work in San Francisco? Okay, SF. How's that? Rainy, boring, everyone here is like gay, or a slam poet, or both. Yes, poor little Jimmy, all alone in a foreign land. Fuck you, Pam. I'm tired.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie. If anyone's looking for anything to do after this thing, there's Forever Magazine's having a big shindig for their new their new issue down at the Ace Hotel. And yeah, I feel like Ellie is kind of having like a literary moment right now. We got this thing, we got the Forever Magazine thing, and then tomorrow, the next author who's reading is actually hosting an event here tomorrow, here at Stories. Who's all reading at that? Allie, you're reading, right? Allie's reading.
Not Alec,
the two editors of Forever. We'll have you hype it when you come up here, but yeah, let me introduce you to John Lindsay. Lives in Los Angeles. His debut novel, Body High, was released last year by House of Vlad. Other works can be found at Moo Moo House, New York Tyrant, Hobart, Volume 1, Brooklyn, and Expat Press. Tonight he reads, excuse me, It's Me, Anton, from the new issue of Forever Magazine. And without further ado, here's John Lindsay.
Thank you.
I like your shirt.
Oh, thanks. I'm going to turn this up so you can't ignore me. Ah, okay. Cool. All right, yeah, so I'm reading this story from the new issue of Forever Magazine, and you should all come to the party at the Ace Hotel that's happening, like, basically right after this. Okay. Here we go. It's an excerpt, so you gotta buy the magazine to hear the whole thing. It's Leonard who introduces me to smoking speed. Right away, I have a way with it. He also introduces me to his drug buddy, Jay. Unlike Leonard, Jay is easy to love. Jay has bad skin and knows he's ugly, but is comfortable saying so, which gives him a surety that certain girls find sexy. Jay works at Taco Bell, but is going to be a DJ. He is the first person I know who genuinely enjoys electronic dance music. I call him EDM J. When we're high, I like to watch him mix and scratch imaginary turntables on the dashboard of my car. It's my first car. Has luxurious all red interior, but the headlining is unglued. So the disconnected fabric droops and touches the top of your head lightly. The sensation of being inside my car is difficult to convey in words, but I invite you to imagine a womb. After I discover how good I am at speed, I stop dosing LSD. My initial revelatory experiences on the psychedelic have taken a turn, and now I think I want to kill myself every time I trip. But I miss the drug's chimeric journeys of self-discovery. I miss the bonds I felt with myself when I couldn't trust reality. Which is maybe why I fall for Amanda. I call her Amanda Hug and Kiss. Amanda is a flirt, has curly hair like heroines in rom-coms before love straightens things out. I watch her twirl the curls around her pencil in our consumer math class. She has an after-school job at the mall selling traveler supplies. I visit at night. We smoke speed in the stockroom behind boxes of neck pillows, carry-on luggage, and anti-malaria kits. If she and I ever did more than kiss, I would remember, because back then I was a virgin. She wasn't. She was adopted and had a lot of questions about who she was, actually. I've been awake for 2 days when I pick up EDMJ in the parking lot of Taco Bell. He's playing with his folding knife, flicking open the blade and saying, "Leonard's gonna get it." Leonard owes each of us $60 for a bag of speed he's failed to produce. Over the few weeks I've known EDMJ, he's mythologized himself as a notorious thug in the rave scene. He waves the knife around like a glow stick. Hypnotic. I've been in a few fights myself, but most I've lost. We smoked the last of our shit in the parking lot of the motel where Leonard's been living since his girlfriend kicked him out. "For show," Leonard says when he opens the door. I wish I could say I was surprised to see Amanda Hug and Kiss there in the room also, laying on the bed wearing Leonard's t-shirt. Just wait for my friends, homie, Leonard says and lights a cigarette. They gonna hook you up. I'm sick of Leonard lying. I want my money, Leonard. Yeah, where's our money, man? EDMJ says near the room's open door. Listen, Leonard says. My friend's shitting gnar. It get you straight. He looks at Amanda on the bed and she stops biting her fingernails, says. Yeah, it's good, Johnny. You'll like it. I look around the room. McDonald's wrappers, tinfoil, tweak pipe on the dresser, tossed bed, Amanda, and Leonard. For a long time afterward, years, my mind will connect the smell of sex to the sour odor of that room. EDMJ sits down in a wing chair in the corner. He gets comfortable. He sure acted hard as hell on the drive over. Amanda turns on the television and all I can do is sit beside her on the bed. Ren and Stimpy plays. A whole half hour. And then the credits. I can tell they aren't real, the fleas that jump between me and her on the bedspread as she flips channels. I follow the itch up my arm. An hour has passed. I say, where are they, Leonard? Soon, he says. Fucking told you already. He's not apologetic anymore. He's been texting. His friends are on their way. They're close. Fuck this, I say. Empty your pockets, Leonard. He gets up in my face. You feeling froggy, Johnny? Jump. Leonard's friends are on their way. But we were friends once, and I'm here now. And so is Amanda. I hold my breath. I reach into my pocket. Before this exact moment, aiming at the light behind Leonard's eyes, I never needed to use the petite canister of pepper spray that was a gift from my mother. And because I have never used the spray, there are some things I don't know but should. Foremost, how to undo the safety lock on the nozzle. The spray misfires across the room in a sideways squirt. Leonard slaps the can from my hand and tackles me onto the hard motel bed. What's up now? Leonard says, punching. I cover up with my arms, but stingers slip through. Leonard holds me by the throat, punching. I can't breathe. What's up? He says in a voice that's both Leonard's and not Leonard's. It's the voice of a man and of a thing that wants to pose as a man. A voice that I still hear when I'm held too long underwater. It comes from the deep as I swim to the surface. I can't breathe. Past the punches, I see EDMJ. He's in his Taco Bell uniform, black slacks and purple polo. No-slip shoes turned toward the open door. Outside, it's Orange County. It's California. And another sunny day. But I'm drowning under Leonard, and the room is getting dark. And then I can breathe. EDMJ drags Leonard by the t-shirt onto the floor. Stop, Amanda shouts, standing on the bed. Guys, stop! Just give us our money, man, EDMJ says very reasonably. He towers over Leonard, fist cocked. Leonard up kicks. Oh, EDMJ says through his hands, bleeding. My nose! Leonard pops up to his feet, but I bum rush him, tackle him against the bureau and the bolted down television. I pin him between the television and the wall, shove his face down into the crevice. When my homies get here, Leonard says, out of breath, they're gone. Shut up, I say, and look up at EDMJ. Where's the knife? What? Leonard says, squirming. Blood burbles from EDMJ's nose. The knife, I say. He reaches into his pocket. Hurry, I say. I have Leonard locked up, and his t-shirt has ridden up. Kidneys, liver, lungs. EDMJ opens up the knife. Stab him, I say, in a voice that doesn't sound like mine. Johnny, don't! Amanda yells. Please, Leonard says in the crevice. Please, guys! The way EDMJ holds the knife tells me he won't use it. So I raise up my hand to my friend. Give me the knife. The air through the open motel door is wet. This close to the ocean, you taste it. Thank you.
Our next reader is Marston Hefner. Marston lives in Los Angeles. His novel... Are you reading from High School Romance tonight? He'll be reading from his upcoming novel, High School Romance, that will be released August 30th by Clash Books. He's the editor and founder of Young Mag, and is a professional backgammon player. Please give it up for Marston Hefner.
I was never a professional backgammon player. Sounds good, though. Very grateful to be here. There we go. Okay, this is too tall. This is titled, You and Me, and like, where do we go after all this time? I fucked my best, most prestigious dog in the world today. Fucking my best dog in the world felt so good. I was at my best when I fucked my dog. No one could hold a candle to my dog when we fucked. I really wanted this story to be great like 500 years from now, but in 500 years, bestiality will be normal. So I failed, since the story will read something like, I fucked my girlfriend, fucking my girlfriend felt so good, no one could hold a candle to my girlfriend when we fucked. Well then, forever onwards. I fucked my girlfriend with greatness in my heart. My girlfriend felt my greatness in my heart when we fucked. My girlfriend felt it so much that she cried. That's how good my fucking my girlfriend was. No one else fucked my girlfriend like that ever before. No matter how much I hurt when my girlfriend left, I was still so great. I was so great because I knew the truth. I knew the truth and my girlfriend didn't know the truth, and that's because I was great. Knowing the truth was great, and I worked hard in this life, and even though my girlfriend worked the hardest, even though she put so many hours into her career, I was even greater than her. No matter how great she really was, I knew even more. God told me I was great when I prayed to him, and God told me I was great when I put words on the page, and God told me that all of my rejections, all of them throughout the whole world, had come because I was great. God gave me a secret, and my secret was dangerous. And then my girlfriend learned that I'd fucked my best dog in the best world, and she didn't think that that was the greatest thing in the world that I could do. My girlfriend thought my dog fucking was my problem and thought it was abysmal, and she never even told me why, no matter how hard I tried to get her to. No matter how many times and how many questions I asked her, she never said why she hated me. And no matter how many times and how many arguments I had with her, she didn't think I was great anymore. My girlfriend was so convinced that I was so sick, she said I was so sick, and she was so tired of being so right that I couldn't even comprehend how sick I really was. She said I was so sick that I should be put in a home where there weren't any animals allowed and there weren't any women allowed, and she said not even her own daughter should be allowed, and so, because I loved her, I was put there. And when I went home without an ambulance, and I went into my front door without my dog jumping up and down, and went into my room with my television set, I said, this is it, Marston. This is the last time you ever fuck something up so bad and forever. And if you fuck something up this bad again, you will be finished and through, and no one will ever love you. So I knew I couldn't fuck it up like how I fucked it up before, no matter how much God spoke to me, and no matter how many songs he sang into my heart. So I went into my study and I read a book, and in between reading the book, and in between flipping the pages, and in between noting the language, I looked at my phone. Even though my dog was gone, I felt my dog on the couch beside me. I felt my girlfriend too. I felt the loyalty of all of them, and I felt the passion of them all. And even the quiet way my dog watched as I read. Despite all evidence, I knew that they were there with me. And how did I know? It's because I read so much and I wrote so much. It's because when I wrote, I felt God and I felt home. And I felt really good at what I did. I felt profoundly good at what I did. I knew the profound and how good it felt, and so I let it speak to me. The The Profound said, I love you, Marston. I love you so much and you are good. You are really special and please don't let other people tell you who you are because other people don't do what you do so well. Thank you.
Thanks, Marston.
Our next reader is Jean-Paul Garnier. Jean-Paul Garnier is a science fiction author from Joshua Tree, California. He's the owner of Space Cowboy Books, our local bookstore up there. He's the producer of the Simultaneous Times science fiction and speculative fiction podcast, and he's the editor of science fiction poetry magazine, Starline. Tonight he reads his epic poem, Beetlejuice Dimming, about the near death of a famous star. Is that? Yeah. Without further ado, here's Jean-Paul Garnier.
The star in question has had a lot of activity lately, and it might go nova in our lives, which would be pretty neat to see. But this is about that eventuality. Receiving word of your imminent nova, we await the neutrino flood, signaling your demise as you dim before us, before in time future colors paint our minds. The night holds new treasures, our constellations change, evenings spent waiting for you to vanish in kaleidoscopic majesty, centuries of wait our telescopes trained. Praying for explosions, tears taint my wonder, thinking of your culture lost in the fiery display. Flowers in our sky shines with our sun briefly. Materials of life stripped away so many centuries ago, reduced to headlines, lacking all essence of your unknowable ways, the arts we will never see. The way of all stars takes you before my birth, weeks of light, temporary remains, we may have spoken, we teething still during your renaissance. Now we listen and see the wake of your silence without having met, we mourn nightly, lament the distances from your star flee, may we meet yet. Were you breaking rocks when telescopes could have warned? The spacefaring, no, still gravity hinders. Home becomes burning prison amidst cosmic splendor. Were you witness to others feel the same way? Beg the contact which could never come. Great voids only growing, slowly growing. If I mourn as I do early evenings, it is too late for worth your perish ancient, fresh. Cosmic rays hold no detail lost in the noise forever. No more shall you redden the sky, small point of miracle punctuating the winter wanderer in endless pursuit, now forgotten your myths of which we were but a pinprick of light. Watching you fade, billions may have fallen, so many stories, dust sails on the medium, we may have loved each other or only misunderstood. Dimming, still dimming, only noticing after being told, as if trivial the many, the multitude wiped away, looking, still looking, fearfully excited. Anticipation rise, stomach drop, your photons arrive alone, careless and random, seeking the coherence, again sadness that times seldom align. Signaling us pre-birth, only aware of visible light in the trees, you thought us non-existent, building our antenna long after signals pass deaf planets. Warm tears quickly cool following the wanderer, blurring the faint point to nothing before its time, before the show of fire, before the end. What signs pointed, fingers outstretched towards oblivion, peering into the expansion as flame nears, seas join sky. A sky blacker without you, larger void. May your rays ignite new material for life. May they stir clouds into order. Dust cloud to dust cloud, memories gone before accretion. Energies swirl. Will they carry our past in shrinking ovals until it may speak again? The light still travels, eternal, dissipating, wanting to be noticed, forever leaving the source, forever containing wisdom and folly, undeciphered by us for now. I wish my eye was planets wide, reading entire spectrum, comprehending all forms of blazing information, memories of every sentience working the waves. The same moistened eye, moved by the opposite of desire, limited in ways you could have shown us, uncommon frames of reference potentially so useful. Those centuries ago, holding each other in the knowing, those who could not escape terrible knowledge, forewarned apocalypse, or blissfully naive in the caves, or in the caves survive, waiting for the air to mix the vacuum a slower death, instant winds of fire, preferable unless needing time for prayer. Nightly guilt descends, a pleasure grimace of beautiful doom, wincing as I remember you circled the dying star when it was life-giver. All suns, infanticide, the time of cleansing, bitter rebirth, temperatures of fusion, matter now joining burning generations, spewing gold which may never arrive, omnidirectional color, heat, warming lovely shores no more, no more tanning lovely skins, pelt or leaves evaporating towards heaven. The beautiful coming apart, my future, your past, we never to share a present. The meaninglessness of now, a now which never comes now, the wanting last. Who watches, thinks these thoughts as our parent swallows her children, perhaps another trite old song, the common lament echoed through the cosmos, reiterated so many times. Implosions infinite, constants still constant, nuclear dance while all spin, pirouette of creation, awareness, the rarity, and now one less. One more to reach its end, rotting on the vine, or venturing towards us or away. May new soil move beneath your extremities. May new seas part with your stroke. Your red pallor, vague ecliptical memories, grace mornings. Each night may be the last when you sail our skies, unhindered by destruction. After fading from my mind within weeks, guilt reduced to eulogies, teach me to sing your songs vanished forever, songs of your people. We lacked the time for images of you, only now seeing the possibilities of a connection never made. If you had waited, if you had a choice. Please send one final burst, archives reaching through space, collections of knowledge spilling through stars. Open arms await the histories of your achievement. Receiving news of false alarm, klaxon of the mind falters in disbelief. Still, our deaths lurk around every shining sphere, truth's relative bending light. Your convexious view, roiling in polished glass, ripples through academies whose secrets public cannot fathom, No, not held hostage, yet amplified through technicalities. Our mistake, repeatable, always so sure in the churning universe. Certainties are flawed, and death will come surely as the sun may not rise. Even if not within my life, someone witness the countless deaths on every glowing horizon, the stellar sway, predetermined and beautiful. Ghastly, predictable beauty, cosmic, dialectic. The Creator's pendulum slants in entropy's favor, cannot truly keep time throughout infinity. Time sped up, a fireworks show for the all-seeing eye, the all-deaf ear, or one who listens, remaining silent, keeping record for the book of time's end. And all this heat dies cold and isolated, when once light peppered the terrible backdrop of endless voids placed there by fluctuations. Receiving word of your imminent nova, all await the neutrino flood, signaling possible demise as you brighten before us. At one time, future colors painted our thoughts. Thank you.
Thanks, John Paul. I got a couple quick ones. I'm going to read a quick one from my new poetry book, Hymns from the Whipping Post. It's called Ghost in Her Apartment. She finally let me in again, this time from an altered state, so she couldn't say, oh, you again. Her crooked mouth, eyes elevate, so I put both feet inside this time, only because of her evacuation. I was a ghost in her apartment. I'm not sure anything has changed. I could commit to creepy crawl it. The furniture could rearrange. Instead, I keep picking up things, returning them perfect to their space, a melancholic compulsion to fix what cannot be replaced. A dissociating ghoul, wondering why I'm here. I float into her bedroom, no answers there either. My own presence is exhausting me. A fatigue lulls me disarmed properly to her living room, but there's no one there to alarm. In order to keep retracing steps, I slam her bedroom door, lie on the couch, cross my arms, a corpse. Since she's not there to touch me, trembling, I feel myself up instead, then fall into a sort of sleep. Wake up, I'm not dreaming, divine the remote, turn on the TV. That's when it fucking hit me. That's all she ever wanted. Sit here, don't talk, just be with me. Back in those halcyon nights when I was a ghost in her apartment. This next one is called Shelter to Cinder. I tore apart the tweaker shack, now firewood for the winter. My little way of getting back at them when they burned their shelter to cinder. Their field mice escaped to bunk with me, assuming they were evading flame. Yet all I'm doing here, waiting for the half-sane human being to earn my heating, a reason to learn the discipline of a controlled burn. I'm gonna read a really quick one from my short story collection, Fallout from Our Asphalt Hell. It's called Straight to the Bone. It was 9:30 when Jacob Shit jumped, startled by a fierce knuckle rap at his office door. Magazine repeating Razor Company in Stanford, Connecticut. Working overtime after his employees left for the day, he was over-caffeinated, thin-nerved, putting the finishing touches on his big deal with the American Chain and Cable Company. This is a 1920s period piece, by the way. Putting the finishing touches on his big deal with American Chain and Cable Company, it would be the most lucrative contract he'd sign in his life. Whoever it was at the door, he was already sure would be the last thing he needed. Before he could react, they knocked again. Harder. Louder. His chest tightened as he walked to the door, shaking his head. He opened the door to three men who looked more upset than he was. The one in the middle wore a strapped tight German leather trench coat under his black fedora, which he lifted up to reveal his piercing gaze. The two flanking him wore black slacks, white button-ups, their ties at half-masts. Can I help you? We shall see how this goes, said the German. My name is Johann Heckels. heir to the Zwilling G.A. Henkels Company. As you know, we are the makers of the world's finest straight razor. Aha, that's great, said Schick, his mood lightening. He assumed this was no more than a poorly timed international elbow rub to talk shop, so he perked up professional. Germans in their wacky time zones, he thought. Would you like to... Before he could invite them inside, the three pushed past him. Mr. Schick, these are my American colleagues from Procter & Gamble, who will make many fine products. For this visit, I will note they provide the best quality shaving creams, soaps, and badger hair shaving brushes. Schick reached out to his hand to shake. The two men nodded, hands remaining in their pockets as they rocked back and forth on their loafers, impatient. All right, gentlemen, great to have you here. What is it I can do for you? Mr. Schick, first of all, we are concerned, said Johann. Concerned that you are making men soft. Soft? Yes, your magazine razor patent. It was unfortunate enough for our company when the safety razor was introduced, but at least men were still at one with the blade when changing them out. While I admire the fact that you were once a colonel and your magazine strip blade replacements resemble a clip for a classic repeater rifle, the problem is that men don't get to handle the blades anymore. Not only has it hurt my company, but you have helped erase a vital part of masculinity in our morning ritual. Sure, well, it's a lot safer. No more getting cut. That's why it became so popular. Yes, but you are making men scared of their own grooming tool. In addition, you've grown so arrogant by the success of your product that you are going a step further. We understand that you are about to forge a substantial deal with American Chain and Cable. Correct. To patent the world's first electric razor, he said, beaming. I could show you the prototype right over at my desk. That will be unnecessary, Mr. Schick. Now, we also understand that while it's electric, it is also being called a dry razor. That's right, said Jacob. No more. He looked at Mr. Procter & Gamble. Soap or brushes to get in the way. His speech nosedived. Aha, you're starting to understand why we are here, said Johann. Mr. Schick, while I commend you on your invention, I'd like you to think very hard about what that means for the future of our companies. Jacob could feel his pores giving hard birth to cold sweat. I'm not really sure what to say. Have any contracts been signed yet? No, that's all happening tomorrow. Oh, good. So we still have a chance, said Johann, finally cracking a smile. A chance for what? He hadn't noticed the Procter & Gamble at his sides until they grabbed both his wrists, holding them behind him like a downhill skier. What? Mr. Schick, when was the last time you had a real blade against your skin? I don't know. I'll take that as so long as you can't recall. Johann pulled out his own personal Henkel's Solingen blade from the inner pocket of his jacket. He slowly put it to Jacob's straining neck. You see, the thing with an electric razor is that they serve only one purpose, shaving, and not very well. Is it true that electric razors will actually stimulate hair growth as it cuts just above the surface of the skin, like right about here, like this? Johann hovered the blade, barely touching his flesh. So it just skimmed the flecks of his incoming growth. Jacob's whole body shivered as he tried to scream through their hands over his mouth. Well, sometimes the old ways are the best ways, Mr. Schiff. The way the straight razor gets the closest shave, he pressed the blade into his bulging jugular, his flesh pillowing around the metal, getting right in there deep to the real root of the problem. He swiped diagonal, unzipping his skin to a crimson flood, then the same slash of preemptive vengeance on his left, the rip briefly interrupted by Schick's collarbone before he gouged it back in for a third. His life ran down his neck, now both sides in a heavy, pulsing deluge. Their hands remained over his screaming mouth to muffle his protests, following him all the way down to the floor. His eyes grew wider until the pleading ceased. I think there is a bathroom down the hall we can use, said Johann, pointing the way out of the office to his accomplices. They closed the office door behind them. They walked the hall. They entered the bathroom. They turned on the hot water. One of them pulled out a bar of Procter & Gamble ivory soap. The other presented a shaving brush, which would be perfect for getting deep under their fingernails. Thanks. Our next reader is Chandler Morrison. Chandler is a novelist, male model, and model male from Los Angeles. He's the author of Splatter Western, Human-Shaped Fiends, the transgressive neo-noir Along the Path of Torment, and the vampire novel Until the Sun. Tonight, we're kind of in for a treat. He's reading a piece called Diet Passion. It's an excerpt from his upcoming novella, Thigh Gap, that hasn't even been announced yet, so you're hearing it here first. Without further ado, here's Chandler Morrison.
All right, so here's the thing. That applause was really weak. So I'm gonna need you to do a little bit better than that. The thing is, come on, there we go. This is vintage Versace. Thank you for asking. I'm basically like Elvis, right? So you guys seeing Chandler Morrison live tonight is the closest any of you will ever get to seeing Elvis live. So that's why I demand that, you know, more rigorous applause. The piece I'm going to read from tonight is special because a couple of months ago I was here and I read a short story about an anorexic who achieved self-actualization through her eating disorder. And I got up here and prior to doing the reading, I spouted a lot of like pro-Anna like slogans, like, you know, skip dinner, wake up thinner. And, you know, nothing tastes as good as skinny feels. And I was like trying to get people to, you know, get psyched about it. And they did not. So it was like dead silence, every joke. So after I did that reading, naturally, the only thing that I could do was write an entire novella about that character. This chapter that I'm going to be reading from tonight, the anorexic girl, she's got this boyfriend kind of thing going on with this douchey guy who's not really that into her, but she's very into him, and he's just a complete piece of shit. I'm sure none of the young ladies in here can relate to having romantic entanglements with that type of guy. And if you say that you can, I know that you're lying, because if guys like that didn't get laid, I would never get laid. So so without further ado, this is a chapter called Diet Passion. My resolve to play it cool with Jasper finally shatters late one night when I take too much Xanax and decide it would be a good idea to take a lift to his apartment in Silver Lake. The driver is playing Christmas music the whole way there. I sit in the back seat, looking out the window at the Christmas lights wrapped around the trunks of the palm trees, and I try to think back to a time when Christmas meant something to me, when it used to make me feel something. The memories are there somewhere, but I can't grasp them. They keep slipping through my fingers like water, like mucus. The front desk guy at Jasper's building calls Jasper to tell him he has a visitor, asking if he should send me up. He listens for a moment and then lowers the phone, putting his hand over the receiver. He asks my name. When I tell him, he picks the phone back up and repeats it. He listens again for what seems like a long time, looking bored, glancing over at me with disinterest. The cold panic is a swarm of locusts in the back of my head. Furious tears bloom in my eyes, fogging up the lenses of my Chanel sunglasses. I blink them back, swallowing lumps in my throat. Finally, the front desk guy hangs up the phone and tells me I can go up. Jasper comes to his door wearing a Tom Ford bathrobe and Matsuda sunglasses, a cigarette in his mouth, and a crystal tumbler of whiskey in his hand. "Helen," he says, his voice toneless. "It's late. You should have texted." "I'm sorry," is all I can say. "Do you have someone here?" He takes the cigarette out of his mouth and stares at me blank-faced for a long time before saying, "No, there's no one here." "Can I come in?" After, again, that hollow stare accompanied by a long, awkward silence until at last he opens the door wider and steps aside to allow me to enter. It's been months since I've been inside his apartment, and the familiarity of its austere minimalism is at once a comfort. "Do you want a drink?" Jasper asks as I take a seat on the red leather couch. "Do you have White Claw?" He stands there looking at me for a few seconds, holding his cigarette at an elegant angle that isn't quite feminine, but almost. No, he says flatly, I do not have White Claw. Nothing for me then, thanks. He sits in the armchair across from me and takes a contemplative drag from his cigarette. The dim, blue-tinted lighting shimmers like water in the lenses of his sunglasses. I don't know why you came all the way over here so late at night, he says. I look away out his floor-to-ceiling window at the glinting gold lights in the dark hills. I guess I didn't want to be alone, I say. My voice sounds small, compressed. Everyone is alone all the time. It doesn't matter if you want it. You can't get away from it. Looking back at him, I say, we're not alone right now. Yes, we are. Rising to my feet, trying to ignore the rush of lightheadedness, I go to him and take the cigarette from between his fingers, putting it to my lips and pulling from it. I take the tumbler from him too, dropping the cigarette into the remaining splash of liquor within it. Setting the glass on the little table beside his armchair, I climb astride him, slipping my hand inside his robe. The taut skin of his chest is hard and warm. When I kiss him, it's like kissing emptiness. There's no substance, no real texture. He doesn't taste like anything. Diet passion, a zero-calorie kiss. In the dim light of his bedroom, he undresses me with staid fingers. There's no anticipatory tremulousness, no breathy excitement. His respiration is calm and even. The lack of enthusiasm is oddly soothing. His attention gives me only the most nominal amount of validation, stopping well short of slaking my thirst for it. But even this is pleasant, in a way. I'm gratified by the lack of gratification. Laying me on the bed, he runs his palms over the hard contours of my body and says, I love how fucking skinny you are. He keeps his sunglasses on when he enters me, and it's my image I see reflected in the lenses looming above me. Not the slugs, not the corpse girls, mine. Looking at the miniaturized versions of myself, I'm as beautiful as I've ever been. It's those twin reflections I focus on, not Jasper's hand in my hair, not the pressure of his cock between my slickened thighs, not the high thread count sheets beneath my back. And because of this, I almost come. Not quite, but almost. And this withheld pleasure is its own kind of bliss. You know where the towels are, Jasper says, collapsing beside me and lighting a cigarette. I get out of the bed and get a hand towel from the closet in his bathroom, wiping off my stomach and chest, the hollow of my neck. It's still me in the mirror, but the corpse girl is behind me, head bowed, a stringy hair hanging in her wasted face. You can let yourself out, Jasper says, when I come back into his bedroom. He's scrolling on his phone, smoking languidly, not looking at me. I'd walk you down, but, you know, I don't feel like getting dressed. Sure, I say. Text me. He looks over at me, inscrutable behind his dark glasses. Text you about what? What do you want me to say? I don't answer right away. The void inside me, my void, his void, consuming each other, becoming one. Coils and pulses, spitting white heat. Staring out the glass door to his balcony, I see only an ocean of blackness, unbroken, eternal. Nothing, I finally say. You don't have to say anything. Later, smoking a cigarette naked on my own balcony, I look at the ground so far below and wonder what it would be like to fall. I wonder if I already know. Thank you.
Got a big treat. Our last two authors flew all the way here from Austin, Texas. First of the two, Autumn Christian. She's a dark fiction writer from Austin, Texas, the author of The Crooked God Machine, Girl Like a Bomb, and the outspoken newsletter Teach Robots Love. And does the piece have a name? Yeah, she's reading a brand new untitled piece. And without further ado, please give it up for Autumn Christian.
This piece was inspired by a gynecologist with a dual life, and also my friend Steph. She wrote me a beautiful poem, so I wrote her a terrible story. Dear Steph, you're like a sister to me, which is why sometimes I want to fucking kill you. You walk into a room in your sundress and your new wedding ring like every corner wants to know you. Cute hair, cute shoes, cute face. Does he know about the fillers? Sunlight always wants to be your spotlight, and he always seemed to know just the right thing to say. That little tilt, little lilt, just enough vocal fry, that poet's memory, that Cornell vocabulary. It's no wonder you've got pity eyes for me like I've been hurt by an angel. But I've seen the way you work out at the gym. You don't deserve that hip-to-waist ratio, just like you don't deserve him. It should have been me. He should have chosen me. I'm the writer Autumn Christian. I have a Wikipedia page. I'm a fucking genius. I'm sure you've heard of the satirical writer Chandler Morrison. That's what he told me right before he handed me $20 for Plan B. I may not have a vocabulary as prodigious as you, but I've got the style to use it. I bet you don't even know how to use your gag reflex. If he was mine, I wouldn't even swallow my spit to make more room for him. And I actually know how to cook. I mean, it's really not fair. I learned how to make grilled fish with sous vide and chicken confit just for him to buy you your dream home. Enjoy your new white quartz countertops. I think the color contrast will really make your Postmates stand out. And now you're pregnant? I'm happy for you, really. Congratulations. I bet you'll have a little blonde-haired, bouncing, blue-eyed cliché. It's kind of problematic, you being a first-and-a-half-generation banana, breeding with a colonizer, but in a way that plowshares would be okay with. I'm sure there's at least a couple poems you can get out of that. And you have to admit, there's something, what's the word, poetic, about the fact that your husband is also your gynecologist. You're always talking about how sex needs a little mystery or it loses its eroticism. What's more erotic than having your husband deliver your baby underneath those squalling fluorescent lights? Maybe he'll give you an extra husband stitch. Yeah, you're welcome. I know your people like that kind of wordplay. Listen to me. Yes, it's true. Sometimes I wonder if I should maybe swap out your prenatal vitamin for rat poison. And I have on more than one occasion wanted to tip a little bleach in your sparkling water. Not to kill you! God, I'm not crazy! I just think some people are so perfect that they need a little miscarriage now and then. But you're still my friend. So believe me when I say I had no idea it was him. Really. He looks so different underneath the bridge. In the dark light, in the ugly fluttering sodium light, he wore this green trench coat with his hair slicked back, and his eyes were so dark they could have been empty. He had sharp teeth and sharp fingernails, and when he touched me, his fingerprints felt like cutting glass. There was nothing familial about him. He didn't talk so much as growl. You don't need verbal consent when your eyes are wide, so open they make the reflections of the stars shake. I won't go into detail about what the sex was like, but I can confirm you married a shape rotator. So you have to imagine my surprise when during dinner at your house, delivery of course, his cuff rode up a little bit and I saw the deep scratches on his wrists. Four of them. It was an unmistakable shape. Coffin nails dragged along the skin. It couldn't be. Oh my God, it was him? I always tried to imagine what it'd be like when you two had sex. He had to be so gentle with his yellow princess. He probably folded your clothes neatly on a side table. Then he left your headband and his socks on. Then, okay, this is at the point where I tried to stop imagining it. I guess you never really know anyone. Not even if you see their back teeth after they unhinge their jaw. Then the pregnancy test came back positive. Maybe I'm not such a fucking genius after all. Geniuses don't go to their friend's husband's office, put their feet in their stirrups, and then feel shocked when the fluttering heartbeat of the child inside them makes them sob. It's okay to cry, he said in that simpering doctor's voice. This is the miracle of life. Oh my God, I wasn't crying because of that. I was crying because I didn't just hear her heartbeat inside me. I heard the one inside you too. And as your husband stared at the ultrasound, the color flushed from his eyes. Next time he glanced over at me, he finally recognized me. He reached over and locked the door. He flicked the light off. The air could have been amniotic fluid. You better take care of my child, he said, twisting the probe hard inside me. His shadow spasmed and grew. It seemed to fill the entire room. I wanted to grab his hand and hiss, as long as you take care of her. But who was I fucking kidding? He was only a monster for me. I'd never get to have the version of him that knew you were a prize. I wouldn't be able to stand forehead kisses and new puppy eyes and the kind of patience required to take all those pictures for Instagram. I needed bruised knees and cocaine and a child conceived in pain. Otherwise, how am I going to justify my hatred of everything you are? If I'm such a goddamn genius, then why can I write all these romantic stories, but I can't even say that I care about you without it hurting me? Because that's what you have that I don't, Steph. Despite everything, you've never forgotten how beautiful this life could be. At 9 months pregnant, I went into labor in your husband's delivery room, underground. You wouldn't have to feel bad for me. I'd gotten used to the idea of being a secret. The sunlit world above was yours, not mine. I was born to be the plaything of a cruel shadow. Our contractions started within an hour of each other. My child came a little early and yours came a little late. He must have taken you to the hospital while I lay in the damp cold beneath the stairs. I'm sorry, baby. This is where your bad choices begin. But then I heard the door at the top of the stairs unlock and swing open. I braced myself against the hospital bed, expecting the usual monster. The last thing I expected was for it to be you. Your husband rolled another bed beside mine and started to transform. One second he spoke in a clear voice, and then the next he devolved into growls. His eyes grew black, clear, then black again. I couldn't quite get a good look at his face. It shape-shifted between the light and the dark, but I could see you clearly enough. I didn't even try to apologize. Besides, there's no real way to say, I'm sorry. There's something about your optimism that just makes poison ferment in my eyes. But you didn't need me to say anything. Because you've never seen me as I saw myself. You never pitied me. Those angel eyes saw me in a light I didn't even think I could exist in. You could have had your perfect birth with your perfect husband. Instead, you're here with me, having your child in my cold little world. I wasn't sure if that was an epidural your husband put in you or liquid nitrogen. I didn't know if he was going to tear himself a half now that he couldn't hide his halves from each of us. I'm scared about what's going to happen to our children. Maybe one will come out a warm cherub and the other with deformed teeth. I couldn't stop thinking about all the way things could go wrong. Yet even in all that pain, you still smiled at me. You reached out and squeezed my hand. A clear, precise thought pierced my dread like it was sent to me directly from you. Here I am. Here we are. Just a little while longer. After all this is over, we'll go upstairs together. That's it.
Awesome. Give another round of applause for Autumn Christian, please. I mean, Stephanie's already kind of been introduced, but...
Yeah,
well, you sure?
Yeah.
Stephanie, you do him is...
No, I didn't send you a bio, so...
Okay, you want to just
go? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Stephanie, you do him.
That was a really fucked up story. And I have to sleep in the same hotel room as her tonight, so I'm like, yeah. So I know, like, it's trendy nowadays to assume that all forms of fiction are, like, autofiction, but that was definitely, like, the brainchild of just, like, you know, monstrous whatever fantasies. Yeah, so I'm not married nor pregnant, but there is a tiny, tiny, tiny seed of truth from which that spawned. And I have a poem which might clarify where that comes from. So, as everyone knows, 2020, the pandemic hit. I, like many other people, became highly online and started talking to weird freaks and weirdos and just like mostly anonymous, right? And one of them was a doctor who claimed to be a doctor and was giving me shit about my supposedly declining fertility. I'm childless. And so I told Autumn about it. I was like, look, I'm talking to this like weird, freaky, like gynecologist. And I wrote a poem about that. So, that's the only tiny sea of truth in that entire story. Okay. This poem is titled The Beetle. With his slick green insect mouth, his clicking mandibles, he says, "It's too late. The obstetrician has become what he collects summers, some anomalous beetle. So I stick him through with a nickel-plated needle, screw him to cork, sit back, dress his name in the gamey gown of Latin, a tongue as dead as he, beneath the white expertise of my half-moon nails. I wonder why he came to this field, if not to strew bug song, to unease female ears, trilling discord. Oh well. I begin to peel his layers off, smug mouth, then wings, just pages of charts churring. Decline, decline, decline. I have half a mind to crush his shell, bleed his anonymity out through a cracked old pen. Hair doctor, you are a tool like all men, but I am a moon. Okay. Oh, I'm a poet, so that's why I'm reading poetry instead of prose. I'm like inspired by the other readers tonight, so I'm trying to read pieces that like speak to what they've been talking about. Chandler had a piece about eating disorder, so I'm gonna read this piece called Eating Disorder Not Otherwise Specified. Part of me wants to be frail, a cracked black feather, or a robin's eggshell in the palm of a giant. I'd be lying if I said I did not want it. Part of me wants to be strong, a giant whose palm striking cracks copper bells and leathers the hides of beasts. I'd be lying if I said I was not a cracked copper bell or a beast. At least I can be both. Sometimes a knell sings into the ether. Other times, silence, a feather across my mouth. Okay, so I'm just gonna read a last poem because this reading's been a long one. This is my only science fiction poem. It's titled, After the Singularity, the Programmer Goes for a Walk. A hedge of hawthorn scythed by moonlight, mute fronds palm the sky like penitence. A yellow plastic bat in the white snow. I see the glow of his cheek, the boy who threw the bat at his feet and flew. Streetlights gild my way. Sentinel swans swerve toward asphalt, chemical and salt dashed for the last of us. I totter like a doe before the pond. Yes, I know the will to die. Childhood's end and men are minds. So I stand and fold my hands.
That concludes our program. Thank you so much for coming, everyone. We all have books for sale up in the front. Please grab one on your way out. And cruise downtown to the Ace Hotel for the Forever Magazine release, and come right back here tomorrow, same time, same place. John Lindsay's hosting one of these, so yeah, it's nonstop. Thanks. Lizzie wants me to read a line from her book. Oh yeah. I see the light, I see the light, I see the light. It fucking stinks. All right. Oh, yeah, I'm awesome. Okay. No, I don't. That's really good.
I was like, I'm pretty sure you won't hate me. Oh, that was really good.